Thanks for joining us for the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast. We're excited to have Dr. Kenneth Yamada as the guest for today's episode. Dr. Kenneth Yamada has been an NIH Distinguished Investigator since 2011 with over 40 years at NIH. He has been a section chief at the National Cancer Institute and currently at the National Institute for Dental and Craniofacial Research at NIH. His research focuses on discovering novel mechanisms of cell interactions with the extracellular matrix and their roles in cell migration and tissue reorganization in embryonic development in cancer. He has published more than 400 papers that are highly cited. His additional interests include research reproducibility, enhancing diversity, and mentoring the next generation of researchers. Ken, welcome to the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Ken, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you're currently working on?
I'm currently an NIH Distinguished Investigator and also chief of the cell biology section in our institute here at NIH. We focus on trying to characterize new mechanisms of cell migration, cancer cell invasion, and embryonic tissue morphogenesis. That is the development of form in the embryo involving dynamic interactions of cells with their surrounding connective tissue like extracellular matrix or with other cells that results in the complex final form of adult organs. One of our interests includes evaluating how the particular experimental model system we use can affect the outcome, particularly in studying cells in three-dimensional environments compared to examining them on standard flat tissue culture dishes, which often gives very different research answers. Currently, we're focusing on trying to characterize exactly how primary human cells migrate in three dimensions compared to their cancerous counterparts, and more broadly, how cells use their interactions with the extracellular matrix or with each other to undergo morphogenesis to form our many organs. So our underlying theme here is trying to reproducibly characterize in depth a variety of types of 3D cell dynamics, whether in interactions of cells with their surrounding extracellular matrix or in forming complex tissues.
Very cool. And so the reason why we reached out to you is that there is an anecdote about your work in the book Rigor Mortis by Richard Harris. And the book says that you spent more than a year perfecting a technique to mass produce a useful protein called fibronectin. Can you please tell us a little bit more about this story?
Yes, that was a rather surprising and humbling experience. So we were trying to produce substantial amounts of this newly described protein fibronectin from human fibroblasts. And as you indicated, over a span of about a year, we developed a very effective way of isolating plenty of this protein that using procedures that actually continued to work well for multiple months. But then, for some reason, the production system suddenly produced less and less fibronectin, and it became untenable. So we changed the cell culture surfaces, the type of medium and serum, extraction times, methods, cell density, and various other experimental parameters, but we were never able to produce substantial amounts of this protein we used to using our extraction methods. Fortunately, we hadn't published the protocol yet, so we wouldn't be embarrassed by that. But unfortunately, it took us even more time to find an alternative means of isolating the protein using a completely different approach involving serum-free medium, active secretion by fibroblasts, and so forth. So we eventually used and published that new protocol, and it's been used by others as well as companies to produce purified fibronectin. But the key point here is that there can sometimes be cases in which we find that a procedure suddenly and unaccountably fails to work. And if we're lucky, which we weren't, you can identify the altered variable. But in other cases like ours, perhaps because we are working with a biological system, we may never find out what happened, actually never did, and had to switch to an alternative approach. But that's the worst case, and there are much better situations that can often occur in this type of reproducibility problem.
At what time of the work did you just say, okay, let's give up and go a different way?
Well, we didn't have much choice because if you can't make enough of the protein, then you just have to switch to something else. And that's what we had to do.
Right. Wow. And you never figured out what was wrong with the other method, right?
That's correct. Yeah, it was unbelievable. But that was the first time that I ever faced that sort of thing. And that really taught me a lot about problems with reproducibility.
Right. Wow. That's a crazy story. Other than this, did you ever experience any other minor tweak, major impact moments in your research work?
I can think of a couple of other examples that fit your theme. One that might resonate with many of your listeners involves a very widespread procedure, that is cell and tissue culture using cell culture medium. So it may not be obvious to many researchers, but the different types of culture medium can have major differences in how their pH is buffered. Most often they use bicarbonate, but the amount of that bicarbonate can differ considerably between different media that you buy. So we, of course, use CO2 incubators for that, which is needed for the bicarbonate in most culture media to maintain the pH near the physiological pH of 7.4. The problem, though, which is widespread, I believe, is that different labs use an incubator set at 5% CO2, while others use 10% CO2 for the same medium. For example, there's a very widely used medium called Dobecos MEM, and you can see in papers, actually, people saying, I used 5% CO2, and others say 10% CO2. And we actually found that 10% CO2 can give a pH of 7.4, and using 5% CO2 gives a pH of 7.6, which doesn't seem like much. But for the particular popular cell line we're using, which is NIH3K3, it gave strikingly different morphologies in these two conditions, particularly in a serum that came from one particular company for some reason. So putting a different type of medium in the same incubator that has a different level of bicarbonate can cause even larger problems with pH. And so this might sound a bit esoteric, but the key point is that even something as simple as the type of culture medium and the setting on one's incubator can have surprisingly significant effect.
Right.
Another example. I can give another example if you want.
Yeah, I would love another example.
So another example involves the use of antibodies. So as others have found, the commercial antibody that you buy may not actually be reacting with the correct protein. And so we found an extremely interesting pattern of protein localization using an antibody we bought. It was a monoclonal antibody against a particular signaling protein, which is PKC-delta. But after extensive subsequent work to actually confirm that this protein was located where we thought it should be in the cell, it turned out that the antibody was actually reacting with a completely different protein, connectin in our case. And this example is not at all unusual. So if we had not done extensive work, including protein sequencing, to identify the actual target of this antibody, we would have made an intriguing but clearly incorrect claim in the literature. Fortunately, identifying the correct protein did result in an interesting conclusion, but involving a totally different protein. So the issue here is it's very important to know exactly the specificity of whatever antibody you use. Another example involves antibody-based isolation of proteins. So we published a reliable method for immunoprecipitating a particular class of proteins, they're called integrins. But several people contacted us saying that their results actually looked much dirtier when they ran gels with other contaminating proteins. So in each case, we probed and found that they had not followed our protocol exactly precisely as written, but had made some very minor changes, such as reducing the number or stringency or type of washes of the precipitate. So we just advised following the directions exactly. And then the answer we always eventually got was that the procedure worked just fine. So even if we try to give all the experimental details, those who try to reproduce findings may not obtain the same results unless they follow the procedures exactly. And so some methods journals, such as Current Protocols, try to deal with that by having side notes, tips, and troubleshooting about each step. But the bottom line is that finding or claiming that you can't reproduce some study can fall apart if the researchers don't follow exactly the original protocols using the identical cell lines straight from the original authors and other reagents. And in fact, this problem of incomplete reproducibility claims in papers submitted to journals, such as, for example, Journal of Cell Biology, for which I'm one of the editors, can in some cases be due to simply not following identical methods and using the same reagents.
Yeah, I think it's really important to always use exactly what was used in original studies.
And people don't.
But hopefully people will if we keep telling them. So you mentioned that you've been a senior editor at the Journal of Cell Biology for quite some time now, and you were one of the co-authors of a feature with the title "What's in the Picture? The Temptation of Image Manipulation." Can you please tell us a little bit about this and how this came about?
So that, I should give credit to Mike Rosner, who did most of the work in that initial study. And the key point there is that I think many of us are used to, for example, fancy cameras that can remove red eye, or there was once from a well-known company a type of software that would straighten the lanes in your gel. And the key point here is that for scientific purposes, you must not modify the image unless you do it uniformly over the whole image and just change brightness or contrast or that sort of thing. And the controls need to be changed the same way as the experimentals. But people get into all types of trouble that way. And actually, the percentage of papers that have serious problems with incorrect use of image analysis is still in about the 1-2% range.
I know there's like a lot of different opinions out there and a lot of different definitions, but what does research reproducibility mean to you personally?
The key feature of research reproducibility in my mind is simply that any conclusion you make needs to be reproducible in other competent laboratories. And so the obvious element is that the experimental protocols provided in the paper or somewhere else must be reproducible by other competent researchers in terms of being in sufficient detail. A related element, I suppose, is that the data that are published must actually be truly representative of what was found. That is not the best case, and that there were sufficient repeats of the experiment to try to ensure that random variations would not affect the outcome, that is, not using so-called cherry-picked data. And then a final aspect involves the specificity or generality of a conclusion, that is, whether the claim is that it applies just the very specific experimental system and cell line or animal model used in that lab, or whether the claim is more general by having been checked using other model systems and so forth. The central element, though, is that someone else must be able to find the same things that you reported.
So there are a lot of factors that can decrease or increase reproducibility, but what do you see as like the most important best practices for reproducibility? What are things that people should really follow as best practices for reproducible research?
Well, from a personal point of view, I really think that a particularly worrisome source of issues with research reproducibility comes from the practice of thinking that you need to so-called prove one's hypothesis. You often hear people say, I did this experiment to try to prove my hypothesis. We should really be attempting to test some hypothesis. And I feel that we should never hope nor very actively try to prove our own or a supervisor's favorite hypothesis. because the mindset when you're trying to prove your hypothesis can lead to a whole series of subsequent issues that are worsened by this source of bias. And of course, there are many sites and sources of information on best practices, which can vary between research fields. So one general source, which I don't know if that's been discussed in your podcast, one general source would be through NIH online. There's a section called Rigor and Reproducibility. And then another source with which I'm quite familiar that came from our committee here at the NIH on Scientific Conduct and Ethics, which is a publicly available case study from 2016 on reproducibility, listing a whole series of best practices or ways in which you can go astray.
And I'll be sure to link both of them in the show notes so everybody can check them out. One thing I saw is that you said that you do training and mentoring of the next generation of scientists. What does this typically look like? And does this also include good lab practice?
Yes. I tell members of my lab that it's crucial, again, that others attempting to replicate their studies find exactly what they claim, whether it involves their so-called representative phenotype or picture, and also whether their description of methods would be sufficient for a beginning graduate student to reproduce their work. So when members of the lab find that they're having trouble reproducing their own findings, it's important to emphasize the importance of course, keeping track of exactly what you did. And then if the results vary, what might have changed? And I tell them that research can sometimes be similar to standing in quicksand, and that it's crucial to first find some stable rock or ledge of a finding or a fact on which to stand initially. And from there, you can go on to identify the sources of variability. In addition, of course, the other crucial element is to make it quite clear whether the findings are general and involve multiple cell types or systems, or whether the findings are specific to a particular experimental model system. So that's got to be really clear in how you write up the paper. And finally, I also tell them that when you get results that clearly go against your hypothesis, it can be a tremendous opportunity to open up some new unexpected avenue of research in which that alternative set of findings will ultimately make perfect sense and provide some novel conceptual advance. In fact, that's been the source of many of our higher impact studies.
And then a follow-up question regarding good lab practice. How do the members of your lab track their lab work? Do you have like a standardized system? Does everybody use paper lab notebooks or an electronic lab notebook? How does everybody track their work?
I try to give researchers in my lab freedom to choose the system that's best for them. But the crucial element is that because their research actually is legally belonging to NIH, it's crucial that it be the notebooks either be left here or electronic files be all here and available. So in that way, I think you can have flexibility in terms of how people best or most efficiently can record their experiments and so forth, but at the same time have material available, which is legally required for NIH and for me if there's some question raised about the work. In terms of electronic notebooks, we've really looked into a whole series of different types of notebooks and have never found the perfect notebook. So that's why I still keep flexibility in my lab.
Right. I think there are like hundreds, I think, now of like electronic lab notebooks. I have like this really big chart that kind of like lists like the most common ones or the most used ones, but it's like a lot. And I think it really depends on what your needs are to pick like a good one, because all of them have like different features and there's really like there's almost too many to like choose which one would fit for your needs, I think.
No, I completely agree. Yeah.
Right.
And we actually do a lot of imaging, and many of these lab notebooks don't seem to be able to deal with that well. You know, a whole variety of different approaches in terms of imaging and the metadata and all that. So it's difficult.
If you were allowed to make a wish for any tool in the lab that would make the life of researchers easier or your life easier in the lab, what would that be?
So that's an intriguing question. So one imaginary tool might be a little robot that goes through all the same steps as a researcher or as I would do during an experiment, and then to see if that robot can obtain the same results both in the same lab, our lab, and in some other distant lab. So the advantage here would be that the robot has presumably recorded all of the steps and motions involved, which might well reduce problems of variability. But if I can add another one, that would be a tool that makes it impossible for people to say that they need to, quote, prove their hypothesis.
I love those ideas. Ken, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your stories and insight on a Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast.
Well, and thank you. I certainly enjoyed it.
This is your host, Anita, and we look forward to being with you for our next episode.